basically had an empty office without budget. And I was told that we don't have resources to work on your technology, but we'll do you a favor and we'll release it to you. It's so valuable. Basically, they said, your baby's ugly and we're not going to do anything.
Howdy, and welcome or welcome back to the Idea to Impact podcast, the show where we are bringing you faculty and community members from Texas A&M to share their stories of navigating the technology transfer and commercialization process. This week, we are talking with Dr. Wei Wan, who is a senior licensing manager for Texas A&M University Innovation Partners. She is a registered USPTO patent agent with over 20 years doing university research and teaching at the university. In today's episode, Wei shares a little bit about her background and how she came to work in technology transfer. You're going to really enjoy hearing how and why she decided to take the patent bar and become a patent agent herself. Let's get started. Well, Hallie, welcome back, or welcome to the Idea to Impact podcast. I am your host, Beth Duermeyer, and I'm joined with my co-host,
Jack Manheyer.
And today we are joined by Dr. Wei Wan, who is our senior licensing manager here at Innovation Partners. And Wei, prior to working in our office, did research. She's taught several college level courses on things like botany and virology, microbiology. So she's going to not just talk about herself and her background, but she's also going to be taking our listeners through kind of what it is that we do here at Innovation Partners. And so this is going to be a really great podcast. We haven't had anyone from our office on the podcast. So Wei, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Beth. Thanks, Jack.
And why don't we kick it off? Tell us, Wei, what was your earliest memory of being a scientist or innovator or entrepreneur, whatever one you want to tackle?
I think I've played all three roles and always been a scientist. And in just like math and science was my favorite subject ever from grade school. My mom always wanted me to be a physician, so I majored in pre-med / biology at college. And then when the traditional trying to go to med school, took MCAT and shadowed physicians on the way. And luckily I got to work with this wonderful woman. She is the head of the oncology department and very smart, very sharp, and the strongest woman I met in my early life. So I admire her a lot, spend a lot of hours shadowing her, observing her work. But finally, I realized, like doing my journey to be a doctor, physician, medical doctor, realized that I'm not strong enough. I see her break into tears while she had to disclose sad news to family with all their hope. Yeah, so it's so hard for her already, and being not such a strong woman and very emotional, I don't think that's the right path for me. So my pursuit of medical career stopped at medical school interview. I went several and decided can't do it. Went to graduate school instead, because that's with a biology degree, that's the closest I can do. And in graduate school, I studied a variety of biology-related subjects. Started as a microbiologist and with virus and immunology, and then with my thesis project in as endocrinology, so analyzing expressions, transcriptional expression, to see how hormones and outside signals adjust human and modulate human body responses. And so after graduate school, I spent 2 years as a postdoc in San Diego, and then spent 2 years in Oklahoma as a tenure track assistant professor where I was responsible of setting up the cellular and molecular biology lab, and we started a genomics center in there. There's a state funded program because we have four Native American tribes in the local area. And part of our effort is to, like, it's in collaboration with the English department and psychology department to educate, like having educational program with those women in those tribes and women in those tribes, and also related project is a genetic analysis, like tracking migration, like population migration, etc.
What kind of education were you doing with the women in the tribes? I know a little bit about public health and kind of some of the work that they try to do with like special populations. So what were some of the things that y'all were working on?
Actually, my involvement was not very biological, not as a biologist. And I'm working with the language department. Actually, we're trying to learn, develop, and maintain their traditional tribal language. And however, most of the language is lost in the tribes, and there not many people can say that. And people like professors in the language department trying to revive it and we are actually teaching them. So to me, it's just, I'm not a linguistic. I'm just there to help. I literally lived in the tribes for 2 months. It's yeah.
Which nation was it? Because you have Cherokee, what, Creek there?
Chickasaw.
Choctaw.
Chickasaw.
Chickasaw. Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it was fun experience, and then my husband landed his first faculty position here at Texas A&M. Yeah. He called me and told me we're going to College Station. Where's that?
That's true.
The same time, actually, I was able to convince my department head that we can work out some arrangement because the chemistry department at my university then was hiring as well. But well, just the rank for chemistry department at Texas A&M is too high. It's like they made him an offer that he can refuse. So for family considerations, we moved here. And for the first 3 years, actually, I didn't unpack a single box. And we slept on air mattresses, and we just like pile up those boxes as shelves and et cetera. So I'm ready to pack and go any minute.
Were you
so here I am.
You were afraid to settle on College Station. You didn't know if it was for you.
No. I had spent too much time on the West Coast in California. So I was ready to pack and go, escape back to the West Coast any minute. But yeah, it turned out we spent 14 years here.
14, wow.
Yeah.
The West Coast, is that where you're from?
Actually, I was born in China, but I was brought here in educational exchange program for the youth and studied as an exchange student in UC San Diego, and then had my graduate school at UC Davis. And then, and after graduation, I stayed as a postdoc. So I did spend quite, like at that time, half my life in California. So I would just stay there for my life.
Yeah, and that's a really pretty, like, UC Davis is a really pretty area of California. I mean, all of California is.
Yeah, and it's so convenient, like 20 minutes driving to Sacramento and within an hour to Berkeley, and then you go to Bay Area just within 2 hours, and within 2 hours you go to Lake Tahoe and you go to Reno. So, yeah.
I have two questions. One, what do you miss most about, say, San Diego or the West Coast that you don't have here? in Central Texas? And then the flip, what do you like most about Central Texas that's different than the West Coast?
Okay, so San Diego is the most beautiful place. It still is for me. And if
there's the weather, the weather and everything, weather. Is that what's beautiful?
It's the weather that you don't have to use air conditioning year long. And I'm a tree hugger. I don't use, I turn off the light right after I leave the room. So right. That matters to me.
Right.
Yeah. But here, I don't know. Constitution is nothing, but I've been here so long. I have my children here and it's just home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can't name anything that's fancy and attractive, but it's just the growth in me already. It's just home.
Yeah, I see. It's got your, it's claws. Yeah.
Buc-ee's. Yeah.
Buc-ee's. I was going to say Buc-ee's, the barbecue.
Yeah.
I mean, I moved to Texas, I guess it was 5 years ago now, having never lived here and being an East Coaster my whole life. In fact, when I moved to Chicago for the first time, I thought, oh, I'm finally in the West. Everybody laughed at me. You're still on the east coast of the east side of the Mississippi, Jack. But so when I moved here, it was a different planet. But pretty quickly, I started to really enjoy it. It's different. It's different. But there is something that grows on you rather quickly. And Buc-ee's is one of the things. Barbecue is the other. And then there's just this je ne sais quoi that I think you're trying to talk about, you know, right way that I don't know what it is, but it's there and it's home and it's kind of comfortable here.
Yeah, especially. And also I think the Aggie spirit and Aggie tradition. I remember the first semester I worked here and I had a bunch of students. They were so like diehard Aggies and we had a discussion. I think they disagree with some of my opinions and then they attacked me as working here doesn't make you an Aggie. I was like, doesn't matter.
The diehards are like that. I remember somebody once saying, I don't think it was me, but I overheard them saying, hey, how long do I have to work here before I can get a ring? And it was like, oh, what did you ask? You asked the unaskable. You never get a ring unless you unless you're a student here. So you're not an Aggie. So yeah, I tell people I'm not an Aggie, but you know, I teach Aggies or I work with Aggies or I do stuff with Aggies. It's the best I can do.
Yeah.
But Aggie, UC Davis is an agricultural school of whole UC system. So I'm Aggie anyways.
That's right.
Yeah. You're just not one of different the Aggies.
Yeah. Definitely.
Now Beth is an Aggie.
I am an Aggie.
Three times over.
My second degree is from an A&M system school, but I don't even know what the mascot is. I think they may be the Warriors.
Doesn't matter.
I was first graduating class as A&M Central Texas.
Gotcha.
And I don't think they had even decided on what the mascot is.
Right.
I think when I was there, it was only like not even a full university. Like you could only do junior level, like senior level courses and then graduate school.
Right.
But my parents aren't Aggies, even though they've lived here.
Right.
Because my dad, you know, he went to Northwestern to do his PhD and then came here in like 74 or 75 and then retired here. But like diehard Aggie fan, you know, of course.
And you're born and bred, right?
I wasn't born in College Station. I was born in Lubbock, which other Aggies are going to like, you know.
Oh no, you touched it.
You touched it.
the amniotic fluid may have touched some of the Tex stuff. Who knows?
Yeah. Right? So there'll be jokes about things that I probably shouldn't mention on the podcast. But I always tell people that I got out of there as quickly as I can. I left there when I was 7 days old.
Wow.
We were adopted. So my sister, I have a twin, flown to San Antonio, which is where our parents picked us up. And yeah, so I said, I only spent 7 days there. So,
you know. All your memories are in Aggieland, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Wow. So
go ahead.
I was gonna ask, you were at Oklahoma and then you came here. When you came here to A&M, were you still involved with research or were you mostly doing teaching?
Mostly teaching. So yeah, at that time, I think the year I interviewed here, there's no openings in the biology department. And then, so I started as a non-tenure track senior lecturer and stayed as a senior lecturer for about 11, 12 years. And the first several years, actually, I was still trying to do research at other professors' lab using their facilities and trying to keep my publication track and hope that I can switch career track. And right. Once they have an opening for a tenure track assistant professor position, I can apply because, well, I did got some grant, like outside grant, and I was hoping with an updated publication track, I can apply and still go back to research. But however, it's kind of determined.
Oh wow!
So if you're on this track, and actually it diverges. So, but I didn't give up. I do research whenever I can, and I read literatures and trying to like write reviews, which doesn't require laboratory facility because doing biological experiment is very costly, and without like real significant funding, it's almost impossible.
What's the focus of the research that you do?
More interdisciplinary because my background, like in my graduate school and postdoc training, I did touch on different field of biology. So biochemistry, molecular biology, genetics, a little bit of like endocrinology and a lot of virology, bacteriology, and immunology. So my, and also I do have a broad spectrum of interest, like still likes solve medical questions. And I was in the debate team while I was a student. So I like legal analysis as well. I do have a broad interest. And that's why I think based on my background, I don't have compared to other PhD graduates, and they focus on one area, working on one project for 5 years straight and then stayed in the area for postdoc. So they do have in-depth training, and compared to them, I don't have in-depth training comparable to them in any of those areas, but my strength is my knowledge and my training is broad enough so I can do interdisciplinary
research. I don't think that's valued enough because I think most people, because the status quo is this hyper focus that you're called a dilettante or whatever if you have a broad interests, and God forbid you might want to explore something new and learn something new and maybe contribute in a new area. It's looked at suspiciously, right? And I remember Freeman Dyson, who had passed away recently, but he was a physicist and he was at the Institute for Advanced Study. And he's famous for proving the mathematics for Richard Feynman's quantum electrodynamics that he got the Nobel Prize for. But he never finished his PhD, yet he still had faculty positions because he said, I can't stand to work on something for 5 years. I'm just gonna get bored. Mm-hmm. And I that's not me. And there's no place for, he would rail against the PhD and the tenure track faculty system that we have for that reason. He goes, you just have people that are basically, you know, technicians that spent a lot of money in this high area, but where's the curiosity? Where's the interconnectedness? Where's the interdisciplinary approaches? We don't do it. And he would rail against those things. So he's probably the one of the rare few that was able to still have a life in that area without and still hold on to his ideals. But that, I think that is, in my opinion, that is a big issue. If you happen to have multiple interests, good luck, because that usually is a strike against you, although I think it should be the opposite.
Yeah,
actually in the business world, I think it's more acceptable that you try different things and you've been creative in your strategies. But however, in biological science, I think people still emphasize on pedigree and you work in the same direction and same area as your PhD advisor, as your postdoc.
Right, right.
So, so it dig a hole and you keep digging until you see the water. And well, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But it seems like through the years, I dug so many holes and well, I don't have much water.
No water.
What was your dissertation about?
It's thyroid hormone receptors. So we discovered actually we studied, so earlier, that was earlier discovery in the lab. So I continue the work on an allele that's created through alternative splicing and study its functions and its meanings in human physiology. So how the isoform helps to adjust different aspects of our body responding to thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormones are very like important hormone. And the indication that I studied most is hypothyroidism. So when you have low thyroid hormone expression in your body, and how does your body respond to compensate the lower level hormone, and how does that particular allele, that particular form of the high thyroid hormone receptor work, function in this whole scenario? Yeah.
I'm nodding my head, but most of what you said, you'll understand, except for like hypothyroidism and hormones, I get that. Because I feel like that's such a hot topic.
Like thyroid, hypothyroid.
Yeah. I feel like women are always like, my thyroid doesn't work and that's why I can't sleep.
Although that's a real thing too, right?
It is a real
very,
thing.
Very common.
It is very common. Yeah. In fact,
It's actually a very important hormone. It adjusts our metabolism rate and also like affect hair loss and et cetera.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. My mom dealt with a thyroid issue earlier this year. I think it was whatever happened, she dropped a lot of weight, you know, like
probably hyperthyroid.
Yeah. Had to go and get on some medication. And, you know, my mom's already like a really petite, thin woman. And then she dropped, I think like 10 or 15 pounds. But when you only weigh 120 pounds, that's a good amount of weight, you know? And yeah, they, thankfully, you know, there's medicine and treatments that very quickly can turn it around.
Yeah. The hormone therapy, I think, is very mature standard practice now. So.
Yeah.
So going from someone who has multiple interests and not necessarily hitting water, as you said, in one area, I have to imagine that was a really good asset for you coming into the technology transfer trade, if you will, because you see multiple, developments in multiple fields in multiple disciplines, and having not a myopic view, but a broad view of the sciences, especially in the biological sciences, was probably a help for you when you decided to come and work in what is now the Texas A&M University Innovation Partners. Is that right?
Yeah, I do think that gives me advantages. Actually, the decision that I made to switch career track to came into tech transfer, it's a good opportunity, but it's like a serendipity. I didn't think about that. I was working on law school and also wanting to go back to research because I was trying, although research is not an obligation for my employment, but I still do research whenever I can find opportunities. And through my research endeavor, actually, we found some discoveries, and which resulted in a technology that can increase the manufacturing of protein therapeutics. So doesn't apply to all, but apply to a subset of macromolecule drugs, like peptide drugs. And I got so excited and filed invention disclosure and contact TTC. Right. But unfortunately, that's due in 2011, 2012. That's only 2 years that a state deficit, and we had like budget cut, and right. And TTC is losing all their employees but one, I think. Yeah, they like everybody's gone. They basically have an empty office without budget. And I was told that we don't have a resource to work on your technology, but we'll do you a favor and we'll release it to you. It's so valuable. Basically, they said, your baby's ugly and we're not going to do anything.
I think we just found the title of our podcast.
Right.
We don't want anything to do with it.
Right.
I took it really hard.
Yeah. That is your baby. It's your research.
Yeah. I really believed in my technology. So I started thinking of ways that I can, since it's released to me, I have the right. And I talked to my friends from law school, say, hey, she's in Baker Boss, so she's in a big firm.
Yeah.
And she gave me a quote. I thought, that's like half a year's salary. I can't afford it. So I decided to work my own way and file my own patent application. And in order to do that, you have to like read all the relevant laws and regulations to see how to apply it step by step and how to draft claims and all those things. And since I spent so much time already, why not just take the patent bar and being a patent agent? So during the process that I was prosecuting my own patent application, I passed the patent bar and registered as a patent agent from the USPTO.
So this is before you actually come and work on the technology transfer side. You just say, hey, I know so much because I couldn't afford to have anybody else do it. I might as well take the patent bar, then I can charge people, or at least I could do the work.
That's I can be my own client.
That's right. Well, no wasted opportunities, right? All of that knowledge, I got it, and I might as well turn it into a credential. It's fantastic.
Teaching, you do have a lot of spare time. I did research, but maybe I can try something else, like marketing my own technology. Right. And at the same time, maybe I can be a patent agent and work for clients and help protect their technologies as well. So that's like the beginning. That's before, at that time, I didn't even think about like being a tech transfer professional. I just want to get my technology protected and get it out there so I can be rich and retire. But yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Tell us, you weren't thinking about going to law school, right? You just had law school friends who had been.
I actually went law school. It's another Like I went UT and they had this policy, like if you were born in China and you need this extra paperwork. I was young and I was like innocent. I went to the dean saying, it's unfair, I protest. And she said, well, unfortunately, the rule is the rule, can't change it. And if it's the current me, I'll say, I'll take it back. I'm so happy to stay and thank you, ma'am. But I didn't. And I said, well, that's it. Thank you and bye. I turned and I left. So yeah, that's, I regret I didn't finish it.
Yeah.
Petulance is expensive.
I didn't have the courage now to do that.
Yeah. So then you say, I've heard the term like patent attorney and I've heard the term patent agent. So what's the difference between those two? Or are they the same?
They are different. Patent attorney, so to be a patent attorney, you have to be an attorney. So you have to pass the bar to be able to practice law. And to be a patent agent is you only have to pass the patent bar, and which is set by USPTO. USPTO is the designated federal agency that has the exclusive right to grant patents. So they work under, we say USC 35, Article 35 of US Code, which is basically the patent law passed by the country. And as a patent agent, so in order to take the patent bar, you need, of course, you have to study USC 35 USC, and also you need a technical background. So only people with certain undergraduate degrees that classified as the like relative STEM area can take the patent bar.
Okay, and, so you just can't come in with like an English degree and decide.
If you have an English degree, no, they want somebody have technical degree so you can understand the technology to be able to decide whether it's like prevented by prior art or not. So you should be able to tell the difference between the current application and other prior art. So some technical background is needed for the interpretation. While in addition to that, if you're an attorney and you pass the patent bar, you will be a patent attorney. So as patent agent, I'm my own client and working here at Tamu IP. And since we are not hired by A&M as patent agent, so I can use my registration to file even the simplest paperwork. We have to have outside counsel to do it. But as a patent attorney with my registration plate, I can represent clients, so inventors, and file patent application, prosecute patent applications, and also like communicate with USPTO all the way till the patent is granted or the patent is completely denied. And even after the grant of the patent, we can still communicate on client's behalf with USPTO to challenge like a granted patent or challenge one of their decisions to deny our application. It's called opposing proceedings, like after a decision is made, and we can still do something. But that's not carried very far, and beyond USPTO, we can talk to the court. So if you want to represent your client in the court, you have to be a patent attorney. And usually the cases that brought to the court are like infringement dispute, and also sometimes challenges. So validity challenges also brought to the court, like say you have a granted patent and then a third party thinks it's not fair to grant this patent, and they can either take it to USPTO or they can take it to the court. And patent law is federal law. So we have in the United States, we have designated patent court is the U.S. Court of Appeals for Federal Circuit. So, and they take national cases. So patent law is not state law, and it's everything's federal.
So if, let's say a patent was granted and then somebody comes back after it's granted and says, you know, I should really be an inventor on that patent and I was left off, and here's proof that I am actually an inventor and I actually helped create this idea. Would that be in like a USPTO type court, or would that be in like a legal court?
It can be both. I think it first needs to be brought in from USPTO, and incorrect inventorship actually is a very serious problem and it can invalidate the patent. So if you have a granted patent and is bringing in a lot of profit and you do not want to be challenged, like especially inventorship challenge, because inventorship challenge usually is very fundamental if you're like, if you're the inventor or not the inventor. And in comparison to the validity challenge of a claim, if you want to challenge a claim, you can always tailor the claim, like work around it. But if for inventor, usually you have fundamental evidence to back up, and it's easier to find like undisputable evidence if you are or you're not an inventor.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that brings us to one of the topics that I usually like to discuss with inventors even before they file invention disclosure with our office, is inventorship versus authorship. Like as scientists, when we write scientific publications, and we do like to list everybody that's contributed to the manuscript, like if I use somebody's data, and I'll recognize, acknowledge their contribution by listing them as a co-author. But however, authorship is not inventorship. And by definition, inventor need to contribute intellectually to the granted claims. So if somebody provided support, if somebody provided like data, but that data is not leading to a certain claim, and those people are not inventors.
Okay.
So
that's really important in the STEM fields too, because you know my publications are mostly in law and social sciences, in which co-authorship is common, but maybe you'll have two or three authors at the most, you know. But in the STEM papers, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, it's like 15, 16, 17 names sometimes because of the authorship issue that you're talking about. And so, you know, someone coming from a social science field or a field where limited authorship is the norm, it probably isn't a big issue to say, oh, I get it. Yeah, you had to make these major contributions in order to be the patent ownership. But for the STEM folks who I'm sure represent the community that do the most patentable inventions, it's got to be something that almost everybody has to have a paradigm shift to say, wait a second, 15 people don't own this patent? It's just me or just one or two, because there's 15 people on the paper, right? So you've got to see that a lot.
Yes. Usually inventors will list everybody, the odd authors on the paper as inventors in the invention disclosure, and then we'll have to sit down and analyze everybody's contribution to see does that qualify them as inventors or not, because I'd rather solve the question before we start the whole process than after the patent is issued and somebody's challenged the validity of our patent. That would be really costly and will be really difficult to solve.
I think we kind of naturally turned into this, Beth, and I know that we were probably gonna try to move it over there anyway, but it worked out really well. But you are talking about when a researcher decides to either talk to you, either pre-disclosure or they actually make a disclosure way. What are the things that you would typically talk with them about? Now, you've mentioned the authorship versus ownership issue. What else are some of those early conversations that you want to have with people so that our listeners here can start to get that in their mind and start to become acquainted with some of these issues before they reach out to you?
Yeah, actually, I do prefer inventors to contact our office as soon as possible, even before they think about filing an invention disclosure, talk to us so we can help smooth out the process and make it easier. And besides, so inventorship versus authorship is something I always bring up in our initial conversation to try to convey the idea and so that we all start the process correctly and smooth out the pathway. And in addition to that, also the publication timeline is very important for us. So because the current US patent law is the first to file. And if publication published prior to patent application, then we'll lose the patent, right? Luckily in the United States, we have a 12-month grace period. So say you publish today, and then you have until November 10, 2021 to apply for US patent. But if you want international patent, it's a different story. For example, in Japan, the grace period is 6 months. And then in Europe, I think you can do it easily in retrospect within 2 months, Canada is 2 months, but you have to pay a bigger fee. So different regions, areas, they have different regulations and we can comprehensively monitor them all. So my easy suggestion is if you have a publication timeline, definitely share with us so we are aware of the publication, and for any technologies that we want to protect, we'll make sure we protect it prior to any publication. So publication does not only apply to you have a printed magazine that's in your hand. An online publication, like a lot of scientific journals, they have the online ASAP. Once they accept it and format it, and then they will just put it online. And that's public disclosure as well. And also, they have some...
Or a conference paper. What if I'm going to Warsaw and many places, nothing's in print, and I share my findings that essentially are the essence of my invention?
You're saying
I could be in trouble there as far as my patentability if I'm not careful, right?
Right. Any public disclosure can be like you're holding a seminar, as long as your audience is not restricted. Like if your seminar is you make it clear and manifest it, like only people worked on the project can listen to this, and you print it there. But if it's open to our audience, and then that means you are giving up your patent, right? Another exception is like offer to sale. And if you are like providing your technology in return for compensation, then you're offering to sale. If you're selling it, you lose your patent right as well. So yeah, that's the second emphasis that I always include in our discussions. And
even because when you apply for a grant and they usually publish the abstract, and that's considered, if you're disclosing your invention in that abstract, that's considered disclosure, a public disclosure, correct?
Right. And that's my next point. So the third one that I always discuss is grant applications. And grant application is crucial because if the research result in this technology is supported by a particular grant agency, we need to know because it help our analysis of the ownership of this IP, if it's federal agency, state agency, or sometimes we have private sponsors sponsor the research, and then we'll have to go back to the sponsor research agreement to see how they define rights and responsibilities. Another concern is just like Beth said, the grant agencies, they do publish the summaries for the awarded proposals. And I got one emergency story. I worked with a faculty and her grant proposal got funded. And then it's okay, so I worked with her on her summary. Her summary is not enabling, does not disclose any technical details. We're fine there. But her grant application is so well written. So she's a great writer. And there is this educational training group, and they want to obtain a full copy of her grant application in their education, like in their course. So they want to analyze her writing style and try to teach people how to write grants. And well, NIH only gave us 7 days to release the whole grant application. However, we're trying to. So in those 7 days, we'll have to work out. Oh, the inventor was on an NIH panel discussion, and she served that panel discussion for 3 days. And during that 3 days, I can't talk to her because they're deciding federal funding, and she's blocked. And I got scrambled intact with the NIH in order to try to ask an extension and try to let them allow us to for retardation, because while my inventor filled the grant application, she checked there's no proprietary information, there's no commercial interest, so everything is for public good. And now that I want to communicate with NIH saying, Texas A&M want to reserve our commercialization right, they said, no, you don't have it. You choose not to. So they didn't give us any exceptions. And we end up talking to, and at that time, I still working at TTC, so the VPR's office makes the decisions whether or not to apply authorized patent application. So I have to pull some strings and talk to the VPR and ask him to give us excuse and authorize immediately so that we can have it protected by the 1 week deadline.
Wow.
And that's such a hassle. So for faculties who wants to or think that the technology may be applicable and maybe has a possibility to be used in commercialization, and do check your grant application that there is proprietary information and we do have commercial interest in this technology, so that NIH will not just simply give you 1 week deadline to release your whole application to the public.
Wow.
So come talk to you early and often is the message to researchers, right? Because you never know what you might have to, even a researcher might not even realize what they're getting into, that area where they need to be careful.